All right, guys, I'm going to call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 10th, 2023. We do have a quorum, so we can get right to work. Thank you, members, for being on time. We have a full agenda today. First item on the agenda is the minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes, Representative Moeller?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Moeller moves the minutes of January 5th, 2023. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. We're going to get right to it with the Board of Public Defense. We have a presentation today, so if you could come on up to the table. You guys have done this before. Maybe some of us have even seen these graphics before. But we do have quite a few new members of this committee, so I thought it was important to start with the basics. If you guys could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your presentation.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense.
And Madam Chair and members, my name is Bill Ward. I'm the State Public Defender.
Well, members, I believe this is in your packets.
It is in the packet.
Yep, they all have even a color version in their packets. I think we're good to just go ahead with the thank you.
As most of you know who are on the committee, our federal and state constitutions provide that anyone charged with an offense punishable by the loss of liberty is entitled to representation by a lawyer. On that first slide, you have a picture of Mr. Gideon in that infamous case of Gideon versus Wainwright. In that case, Justice Black's decision, he mentioned that lawyers in these cases are necessities, not luxuries. In Minnesota, the Board of Public Defense is the entity charged with enforcing those rights or defending those rights. The board is a judicial branch agency, independent of the Supreme Court's direction. It consists of seven members. There are four attorney positions appointed by the Supreme Court and three non-attorney positions appointed by the governor. Duties of the board are outlined in Minnesota Statute 611.215. The board sets the standards and policy for the public defender system. It appoints our chief public defenders in each of the judicial districts, appoints our chief appellate defender, our state public defender, and then allocates the funding that you all provide in the biennial budget. The board is organized into three programs. You'll see those on page five of the slides there. Our district public defense, our appellate office, and our administrative services office. Underneath that district public defense function is also the public defense corporations, which we'll talk about in a little bit. On page six, the district public defense. District public defense provides constitutionally mandated services in felony, gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor, and juvenile delinquency cases. It also provides statutorily mandated services for children 10 years of age and older in child protection cases. Excuse me. And the appellate office provides constitutionally mandated services in criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, and supervised release proceedings, or what we used to call parole revocation hearings. I mentioned our public defense corporations. There are four public defense corporations in the state. These actually predate the creation of the public defender system or our state public defender system. They're statutorily mandated funding. We are the grant administrator for those four corporations. And they provide public defense services in anywhere between 3,000 and 4,000 cases a year that would be public defender cases if the corporations didn't exist. You can see on page 8, it's the Minneapolis Legal Rights Center, our Neighborhood Justice Center, Duluth Indian Legal Services, and then the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, which provides service to the folks in at Leech Lake and White Earth. Madam Chair, on page 9 of our presentation, you can see our service provision. We have 10 district offices. We have 16 what we call satellite offices, and we have 158 part-time public defenders. And we'll talk about those in a little bit. They really are the backbone of our service provision in Greater Minnesota. On page 10, you can see the budget for 2023. About 90% of the budget is personnel. Another 6% is what we call mandated costs. Those are things like rent, mileage, phones, data lines, all of those things that have some kind of contractual obligation. Our staffing, page 11. We have 911 total staff when we are fully staffed. I will tell you right now, and we're going to get into this in the budget presentation sometime later, we are not fully staffed. But when we are, we have 911 total, 553 assistant public defenders. Out of those 553, about 30% of them are our assistant, are our part-time public defenders. I mentioned part-time public defenders as the backbone. These are folks who, by and large, run a private practice or take private cases. They are small business people in, you know, whatever town they may be in. They work for us 75, 50, or 25% time. They are state employees, so they're eligible for state benefits. They take whatever cases are assigned. They cover their own office overhead. The board does provide a small stipend. If you're three-quarter time, it's about $6,600 a year. Those of you who are lawyers who practice, you know that goes nowhere near what it costs to run an office. When I say they are the backbone, they are the backbone in terms of being in places where we don't have a full-time office, so we don't have to run people from one county to another. We still do that, but you can imagine if we didn't have those folks in those communities, how many more miles our folks would be putting on. The other thing that they help with is conflict cases. Because they are not in our offices, they can handle multiple clients or conflict cases that our main offices would have. On page 13, Madam Chair, we start with our cases. We are the largest user of the court system. 126,000 cases last year on the district court level and increasing. We did have somewhat of a break during COVID in terms of the number of cases, but those numbers are going back up again. 1,300 appellate files that were opened by our appellate office. We still have, and I'm sure the courts will be talking to you about this later, about 9,000 case felony and gross misdemeanor backlog from the COVID pandemic. 4,000 supervised release cases. Our public defenders provide mandated service in every courthouse in the state. On page 14, public defenders cannot refuse cases. You have seen this graphic. Those of you who have been around a little bit have seen this graphic before. We have two Supreme Court cases, state Supreme Court cases, that state that public defenders cannot refuse cases. The picture on the bottom is the pothole picture, and it's one that we've used quite a bit. If we have 20 potholes on I-94 between downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul, if DOT's only got the staff or the funding to fill 15 of them, we swerve around the other five. If I've got a public defender that's got 20 people standing in the hallway waiting to talk to them or in their office, they can't take the first 15 and say, well, you other five have to find somebody else. It doesn't work that way. We cannot refuse those cases. At the same time, on the next page, you can see that our lawyers are held to the same standards that private lawyers are. These are a number of the recent U.S. Supreme Court cases that talk about clients' rights in terms of plea negotiations and also immigration consequences. So at the same time, again, that public defenders can't refuse cases, they're held to the same standards that private lawyers are. On page 16, district defense, our case types. As I said, it's about 126,000 cases last year. About a third of those are misdemeanor cases, about a third of those are gross misdemeanor cases, and roughly 20% or a little bit more than that are the felony cases. What we do is we break that down into what is called a case unit, and that's on the next page. A case unit is roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor, and it allows us to compare cases and across district lines, because there are people that do, a number of people who do multiple cases. They just don't do felonies or they just don't do misdemeanors, particularly in greater Minnesota. They do a multitude of cases. We're going to talk a little bit more about this in the budget presentation, but that case standard is from 1991. You can all imagine how much more complicated cases are in this day and age with scientific evidence, with collateral consequences, with audio and video, all of those things. Madam Chair, brings us to workload, case and workload challenges. If you look on that page 18, I guess it is, recruitment and retention. I don't think it's anything that you all haven't heard in either your private business or here. We have been hit by the Great Resignation. We lost almost 15% of our staff through resignation last year. At last count, we had 65 attorney positions around the state that were vacant. That is roughly 12 or 13%, I think, of our total staffing. And our applications are down anywhere from 50 to 75%, which is pretty consistent with other systems across the country. And I think when they said, when you hear from the courts, I think you're going to hear some of that as well from there. So, other challenges, page 20. Obviously, COVID-19 was a huge challenge for us. Obviously, keeping everyone safe was the primary concern. Getting people working remotely. But that also comes with a cost, right? We did it, we got by. It was not ideal for clients, it was not best for clients, but we got by. In-court hearings taking 2 to 3 times longer. You can imagine that when you had your hearings, Madam Chair, here, remote hearings, there were certain advantages, but they took an awful lot of time. We still have a 9,000 case backlog. The other piece I would mention about the remote hearings is we found out very quickly how big an issue broadband is in rural Minnesota. And I think we talked about this last year as well. We had clients in the McDonald's parking lot because that's where they could get their best broadband from. And I know some of you around the table from greater Minnesota are shaking your head that that's still a major issue in a number of parts of the state. So I mentioned the increased use of audio and video. Page 21. When I started this job, never in my wildest dreams thought this is going to be a major issue. And it has become not only a major issue for our staff, but a major cost factor for us. In the last 6 months of 2022, we collected 61 terabytes of data. That's 15,000 two-hour movies, and that's only from 22 counties, and that didn't include Hennepin County. We're bringing Hennepin on in the next months. We get 7 new terabytes of data each week. Our storage costs now are in the excess of $1 million a year. We just signed a contract just in the last few weeks that's going to lower that some, but it's still going to be in the 850,000. The biggest issue, or one of the biggest, is the attorney time to review. How do you review all of that information and that video in a timely manner in order to be prepared to go to court? Another challenge, scientific evidence. Evidence must be analyzed for the way it's collected, processed, analyzed, and reported. Think about it again. Things that have changed since 1991. Computer forensics, drug analysis, fingerprint analysis, DNA, ballistics, arson reports, particularly the DNA with the touch DNA. There are very, very few case types, I should say, that now don't involve some kind of DNA evidence. It is just the advancement of that science. A major challenge, again, nothing you haven't heard before and encountered in some of your other committees, clients with chemical dependency issues. Major issue for us. These stats are a little bit outdated, but the Department of Health noted that 80-90% of Minnesota criminal cases involve alcohol, drug abuse, or some kind of addiction. I think the sheriffs came in last year, or have come in the last couple of years to talk to you about how many people that are in those county jails are suffering from chemical dependency issues, mental health issues, brain trauma issues, or a combination of those. Somewhere the estimates are 35-40%. Those are all our clients. Lastly, language and cultural barriers. We are becoming more diverse as a state. And my sister-in-law just retired from the Minneapolis Public Schools 2 years ago. When she left, there were 83 languages that were spoken in Minneapolis Public Schools, which, again, just amazes me. But again, cost of interpreters, the time it takes to speak with your client, to get them to understand what is going on in the system, to develop a relationship with those clients, all takes that much more. And lastly, Madam Chair, federal, state, and local funding decisions, some of which emanate just from this building. You know, we talk about more money for fighting crime. We talk about more money for police, more money for prosecutors. We're not here to tell you those are bad things. We're not here to oppose those things. But that increases the demand for services. It increases the caseload. It increases the workloads for public defense. And so those are kind of the challenges. I know, Madam Chair, it went very fast, but I know you have a full agenda today. I'm assuming we're coming back at some point to talk about the budget. And with that, I guess we would stand for any questions or inquiries that committee members would have.
Yeah, thank you for coming in today. Yes, we will have them back to talk more in depth once the governor's budget is released and we're kind of on that phase of things. However, given how close we were to moving forward on additional funding for public defenders, we did want to bring this forward sooner than later, now that we're all back here getting to work. And I really appreciate you guys coming in. We can take a couple questions, but obviously we have a full agenda today. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, the testifiers here. One thing you said about what the public defenders do, but I think some of these members, especially some of the new ones, would like to know what are the qualifications to qualify for a public defender in a case?
Mr. Warden, I don't know if you've spoken yet on the record, so you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your response.
More than happy to do it again.
Yep.
Bill Ward, I'm the state public defender. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the qualifications are the same as for any law firm or prosecutor's office. That's be a graduate of a law school and pass the bar. Ultimately, we look for people who have the desire to do the work that we do, which is not everyone. And we have a vetting process in the hiring and recruiting part of our agency. Determine this is the area of work that people want to participate in.
Mr. Ward, I believe the question what he was actually trying to get at, I believe, was what are the cutoffs for a person to qualify for a public defender?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Also important to have on the record, but
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Kyer.
Those are outlined in statute. The defendant or someone who resides in the household receives mean tested government benefits, or that the court determines that through a combination of liquid assets or income, someone couldn't pay the reasonable cost charged by private counsel. which again tells you why we have the number of cases we do. If ever any of you have hired a lawyer in the last few years, you know that it's not a cheap proposition.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Representative Johnson.
I have two follow-ups. One is, Chair Beckerfin, one is if one was appointed and it was later found out that they did not qualify, what is the ramifications for that purpose, and how do we get the funding back to the program for those who need it?
Mr. Ward or Mr. Kier?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's also handled by statute. If we learn at some point later on that the person has inherited money or won the lottery or in some way is not indigent anymore, we are to notify the court or have the client notify the court. There is no way of recouping the time and energy and money that we put into the cases, but the example that you're asking about is so incredibly rare. 99.9% of the folks we represent absolutely are indigent and deserve our representation. The courts do a very good job at vetting.
Final follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, generally, overall, it's been very good that they've done it, but I know in my county we've had people that have misled the courts and actually got the public defenders, later found out it's different. It happens more often than we like to know about. Then the last question I have, of the 9,000 case backlog, I know in my area we have no backlog anymore, and mostly across the state. So I'm just wondering where these 9,000 case backlogs are in the court system, which district or which counties.
Mr. Ward or Mr. Kier?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the Chief Justice notifies the chief judges of every district on a monthly basis as to where those backlogs are. You're in Isanti County, and it's a smaller county, and people work very diligently to resolving those backlogs. But some of the larger counties and even some of the smaller counties, it's very difficult because we don't have as many lawyers as we need due to resignation, retirement, and working diligently to be prepared to resolve the cases in a timely manner.
I'm sure when our staff can follow up too with the courts to see if we have that information and make sure that the committee has it. All right, members, I think we're going to move on to House File 90. So I'm going to pass the gavel for the first time to my vice chair, Representative Frazier. Going to get right to it, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
All right. I will move House File 90 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means and get the bill here in front of us. Members, this is for those of you who have been on this committee for a while. This is not the first time you've heard about this issue. We just heard from the Board of Public Defense about how it's constitutionally mandated that folks have a right to counsel and a right to effective assistance of counsel. It's well-established law here in the United States. Our criminal justice system here in the U.S. relies on a couple of basic principles, and one of those is that you're innocent and proven guilty, and the other one is that you, if you're facing criminal charges, that you would be provided an attorney if you cannot afford one. We don't want justice to depend on your ability to pay. And so with that, as we just heard how important our Board of Public Defense is and our public defense system is, House File 90 is pretty straightforward. It funds that system. 2 years ago, when we started having these conversations, we finally asked the question, what would it actually take to fund this system adequately? Not what would it take for the Cadillac plan? What would it take to have the best system in the country? What would it take to be adequately meeting the needs for our citizens by making sure that those caseloads are manageable and that people have the counsel that they are entitled to under the U.S. Constitution. And that's where the numbers in House File 90 came from. This was the amount that we were told that would need to get us to that point. And so this has been a journey as we've moved this forward. We have had support, bipartisan support, bicameral support for this over the last 2 years, and given that the need is there now, we thought it was really important that we bring this forward now. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Your first testifier is Mr. William Ward. Please come down.
You're back.
Again, Mr. Chair, my name is William Ward. I'm the state public defender from Minnesota. I understand the nature of the time constraints we have here, so I'm not going to regurgitate what Mr. Kyra just presented to all of you. We have another trifecta in this state. It's not just the wealth of the DFL taking control. It's the trifecta of recruiting, retention, and workloads, which are doing tremendous harm to our ability to represent our clients. The word trauma is something I don't like using when describing what's happening to my staff, but that's exactly the traumatic effect that's occurring due to the pressures of working on these cases when we don't have enough and adequate staff to do so. Our numbers are not nearly what they need to be to represent our clients in the way that all of you should demand on behalf of our citizens. We don't have that collateral. We also have a situation of recruiting and retention where people don't want to work for us right now because the pay is too low. There's no parity with the county attorney's offices throughout the state. And we represent individual clients, not entities. We have clients who come to us in tears and fear and anger because of how they're being treated in the court system. And they feel that they're getting the shaft by us because we don't have the time or the energy or the ability to do what we should be doing on their behalf. What is being requested here, we have great thanks to the board or to the chair here, to all of you for what is being presented on our behalf. We also presented a budget to the governor that we'll be having discussions about as time goes on. But I really encourage you to think about if your son or daughter or nephew or uncle or cousin were in trouble, would you want us to represent them? You should, but would you now in the state that we're in and we have been for the last two decades? I thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Our next testifier is Brian Aldis.
Thank you. I want to thank the chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to appear before you today. On behalf of the Board of Public Defense employees represented by Teamsters Local 320. My name is Brian Aldis, and I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 320. Teamsters Local 320 represents roughly 10,000 plus public employees across the state of Minnesota. Today we're here speaking in support of the Minnesota Board of Public Defense increased budget request that's been presented to the governor. The budget requested will provide competitive compensation to the Board of Public Defense employees and provide the agency with the ability to fully staff its organization, which would make caseloads more manageable. Included in those 10,000 plus public employees represented by Teamsters Local 320, 650 of those members are attorneys, dispositional advisors, paralegals, investigators, and tech support staff that work for the Minnesota Board of Public Defense. We have been the collective bargaining agent for the public defenders and their support staff since 1999. The Board of Public Defense has historically been underfunded and unable to provide competitive compensation to its employees, attract new employees, or retain its current employees. The Board of Public Defense, as an example, I should say, lawyers hired, Mr. Kyer mentioned the importance of, for example, part-time public defenders. Lawyers hired as part-time public defenders are averaging 1,600 hours of work per year for the Board of Public Defense while they try to maintain their private practices. Half-time public defenders are required to provide 910 hours as an example, and three-quarter time public defenders are required to provide roughly 1,365 hours as another example. The Board of Public Defense employees represent 80 to 90% of criminal defendants in Minnesota. They continue to face extraordinary caseloads, understaffing, and insufficient resources, making it possible for them to do their jobs to the best of their abilities. Because of that, they're increasingly concerned that by forcing them, as is required by the Constitution, into these extreme and unmanageable working conditions, they have concerns that there is the potential to violate a defendant's constitutional right. Minnesota's criminal justice system cannot meet its needed reforms until the state actively supports its essential Board of Public Defense employees with an adequate budget that provides for proper staffing, competitive pay, manageable caseloads, and critical resources. I know I'm on a short time leash here, so I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aldis. Up next, Eric Senvik.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Senvik, and I'm a Second Judicial District Public Defender. I've worked in Ramsey County for the past 16 years as a public defender. Before that, I worked in Greater Minnesota in the 10th District and Isani County for 2 years before that. Throughout my career, I've represented thousands of people that have been charged with everything from low-level misdemeanors to the most serious homicides and criminal sexual conduct cases. Currently, I'm in the juvenile division in Ramsey County representing children as young as 10 or 11 years old, charged both with delinquencies and also representing them in certain child protection cases. We represent about 85% of all people that have been charged with felonies in Minnesota as an agency, and nearly all the children charged with delinquencies in juvenile court. In the 60 years since Gideon versus Wainwright, the Supreme Court decision in 1963 that said that indigent folks charged with a crime are required to have a lawyer appointed at government expense, the work of public defenders has expanded exponentially, both in caseload and the complexity of the cases that we handle. When I started 18 years ago, we still got our reports on cassette tape. Now you can't find a cassette tape player probably anywhere. The work now includes sorting through hundreds of hours of body worn camera footage from arrests, custodial interviews, and everything else that is on video. I can think of a case and a client that I represented last summer. He was a juvenile child who was charged with a crime. He was in custody, which means he had to have his trial within 30 days of being arrested. There were probably 8 or 10 police officers who responded. There was surveillance video from part of the incident where my client was said to be getting out of a certain type of car near a store. Upon further review of the tape, and after having time to build a relationship with my client and develop trust with my client, which has to happen very fast in a juvenile case on that type of timeline, he was able to admit to me that he was not the person driving the car, and he had the time to be able to sort through the video, and that video evidence actually backed up his story. We were able to resolve this case, and my client pled guilty to what he was actually responsible for during that day. He was put on probation, received services, and I can report that 7 months later, he's not violated his probation once, he's completed most of his programming already, has a mentor, and is back in school again. Having enough time to do this, having the investigators, support staff, to help with all the behind-the-scenes work that has grown exponentially over this time, allows good outcomes like this to happen, and I'd argue it helps increase public safety in our communities as well. We talk a lot about backlog. There's 1,000 case backlog right now in Ramsey County. I talked with Thompson Carter and other people from our office that sit in about 1,000 cases, and that's only the felonies and the gross misdemeanor cases that are backlogged. Yeah, and new cases come in every day. Certainly our agency has lost people over the last 5 years. I was looking at a phone list from 2017. About half the people on that phone list no longer work here. You know, and the people that leave our agency, they talk about a couple different things. They talk about the crushing caseload and the emotional and physical toll they take, and the low pay. You know, in our office, the Attorney General's office is one floor below ours. An attorney that's worked in our office shouldn't be able to ride the elevator down one floor and get a $20,000 raise by switching jobs. That isn't fair. We need to be paid the same, not thousands of dollars less due to our constitutionally mandated jobs. I'll close with just a brief story. It goes back to 1987. I was a ninth grader at Eden Prairie High School. My teacher, Steve Swadzinski, you might know him as Senator Steve Swadzinski from the West Metro right now, used an example to talk about the checks and balances of government. Use an analogy of a three-legged stool. Each leg is a branch of government, the executive, judicial, and legislative branch. If one leg or branch is too short, the system is out of balance, and it isn't fair. In our work, the executive branch is represented by the police, county attorneys. Courts are representing the judicial leg, and the public defenders represent the people or the legislative branch. We're not fully funded, meaning if we don't have enough money to fully fund the agency, to hire enough lawyers, support personnel, pay them a salary equal to what others in the system make. The stool in our system of justice is out of balance. I ask you to fully fund our agency in this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sembit. Next up is Kara Gilbert.
Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Kara Gilbert. My pronouns are she, her. I'm an assistant public defender in the 2nd Judicial District. I was a special education teacher for 20 years before I went to law school. I've been a public defender for almost 9 years. Please don't do the math on that. My caseload involves juvenile cases and adult homicides. I am assigned every case that comes through on the calendars in which I am picking up. I do not get to pick and choose. I do not get to have an opinion about what my children did or what their personalities are like or who their families are. I represent every one of those children and adults to the best of my ability. But this work takes an enormous toll on all of us who do it. Body camera and squad video have exponentially increased in just the time that I have been a public defender. A simple traffic stop, 3 or 4 hours of video to review. A serious felony, hundreds, if not thousands of hours. I have had cases with thousands of hours of video. And what is buried in that video is what really happened. And if I don't review all of that video, I don't know what was said on scene. I don't know which car the person got out of. I don't know who threw the first punch. I cannot tell you the number of cases in which what was in the video was either entirely exonerating or at least mitigating enough for my client that the outcome was nothing like what was originally charged in court. And that is the crux of what we provide. When we do our jobs well, our clients admit what they need to admit, they take responsibility for what they need to take responsibility for, or the court finds them responsible, one or the other, and then we move on to the most important part, treatment, programming, supervision, and change. We can't make change if people don't feel heard. We can't make change if a system is shoehorning people in for things they did not do and increasing resentment rather than helping people take real accountability for what happened. But this work takes a toll. I have a very, very good friend who just left our office. She found a place to do work with the same clients in a different kind of office, not a public defender's office, and got a 25% pay increase. And I don't blame her at all for taking it. I have a colleague who qualifies for and lives in subsidized housing. I have many, many colleagues who either do not replace or repair cars that desperately need it because they can't afford to. None of us expect to get rich doing this. We didn't go into it to get rich. But an incoming prosecutor in Ramsey County with no experience makes more than I do. How is that valuing the rights of Minnesotans? It's not. We all handle caseloads far in excess of what the national standards would say. We are forced to prioritize which video gets watched, which clients get our time and energy, and clients are forced to wait for us to get to them. I represent children, almost exclusively children of color, from the poorest neighborhoods in St. Paul. My children have faced incredible trauma in their young lives. I have rarely had a child who hasn't lost a friend or a family member to violence. They have experienced homelessness, domestic violence, and treatment that would horrify us if our own children were treated that way. I am more than a lawyer to them. Sometimes I am the first person that they have trusted enough to tell the whole story. I need time to build that trust, to help them understand who they are and what they need to change. And if I can do that, one child at a time, we can make a real difference in what our children are doing every day. But it takes time, and it takes years to build the skills to do this work well. And if our lawyers don't stay more than 5 years, we don't have the capacity and the trained lawyers to do what we need to do. We need more lawyers, more dispositional advisors, more investigators, more paralegals, and more legal office assistants. Our clients deserve good representation. Our city and our state benefit from that every bit as much as our clients do. The streets are safer when we meet our clients' needs because they are much less likely to reoffend. Policing is safer when we're able to watch every single video and give every case the attention it deserves because nobody watches more than we do. We can and we should do better. Minnesota is better than this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. I see that we do have one public testifier signed up, Rayanna Buchholz. Did I get that right? Or close?
You did. I'm very impressed. Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rayanna K. Buchholz, and I am the Legislative and Coalitions Director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. AFP advocates for a society of equality where constitutional rights are upheld for every citizen. I am here to testify in support of House File 90, the funding allocated for the Board of Defense. While we are generally hesitant to support drastic increases in funding to government programs, we believe in this particular case that it is necessary to ensure that the rights of the criminally accused are upheld, that individuals facing charges have adequate time with their public defender, and that public defenders have sufficient time to assess and execute cases in the best interest of their clients. Prosecutors themselves have also supported increased funding because it helps achieve justice and process cases more effectively. The Board of Defense is and has been chronically underfunded, overworking public defenders and staff. This leads to individuals who are facing criminal charges to receive inadequate representation and attention by their assigned attorney, contrary to their constitutional rights. Public defenders, as we've heard, are leaving the profession in record numbers, in addition to the issue of a starting salary deficit between public defenders and prosecutors that we at AFP would like to see equalized. Public defenders play a vital role in executing the due process for the rights of the criminally accused as constitutionally mandated. We believe that justice should be upheld across the board regardless of income. Crime should not be punished because of an individual's economic status, nor should it be the penalty of an underfunded institution. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no other public testifiers signed up, but I will ask if there are any other public testimony that would like to come down and testify. If you please introduce yourself for the record.
Attorney Eric Kernel. I've been practicing for 30 years, and I just wanted to mention with respect to the Child Protection Service cases over the last year since the new law was passed providing legal assistance, the low-income parents I've talked about are not satisfied with the level of legal services. They need more. These are cases involving their families being separated, and they need more legal defense help from the public defenders. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll now move on to member questions. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I strongly support this bill. Public defenders are heroes. They don't just represent their clients, they also represent our adversarial system of criminal justice. When they're able to do their job effectively, the entire system is more just and more effective. So I'm very excited to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing this bill. You and I are, or you were a prosecutor, and I'm a prosecutor, and I just want to say how important it is to fully fund our public defense system. Although I sit across the aisle often from the public defenders on the cases I work against, I have nothing but the utmost respect for the work they do. And I just wanted to reiterate the amount of camera footage that's coming in these cases is quite extensive. And then finally, just wanted to say that when I talk in the Public Safety Committee about how important it is for trust in our system, having trust in the system also includes making sure that our constitutional services of public defenders are fully funded. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rick Mueller. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be on the record as supporting this. This is long overdue, and this is a constitutionally mandated issue that we should, for the reasons stated by so many, fund. We can't afford to have people go without representation. We already have a backlog in the courts, and if we can get more people that are, you know, being prosecutors and public defenders, then hopefully that will help with the backlog as well. But it's a constitutionally mandated issue, and we need to fund it.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Becker Finn, I don't think I said this at the beginning, but you would like this bill referred to Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was my motion. Okay. And if it's okay with you, I'll just go ahead with my closing.
Yes.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our testifiers. And again, thank you for the support from near unanimous support over the last couple of years. And I really appreciate everyone who's taken the time to testify. And just, you know, to reiterate, you know, we are talking about whether somebody's personal liberty is going to be withheld when we're talking about a criminal case. And ultimately, that's a right. That this right to counsel when you're faced with that in front of you is something that we should all support. And I just really appreciate everyone here. Again, this bill is not the Cadillac plan. This is right now we've, you know, the way that the system's been limping along right now, you know, it's sort of like we're hitching rides, we're taking the bus, we're maybe riding our bikes, and we're just trying to get us to a functional vehicle so that we can meet those minimum caseload standards for folks across the board. So would renew my motion that House File 90 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
With the motion for House File 90 to be recommended to the Committee of Ways and Means, I will, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Motion passes. It will be referred to Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Good job, Vice Chair.
All right. Moving right along. Welcome to the committee, Representative Katiza Watoon. Since you are not on this committee, I will move that House File 1 be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Please go ahead and tell us about House File 1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I may, right before I get started, and Mr. Landvik, before you leave the room, just wanted to give a quick shout out. Senator Swadzinski and I are always thrilled when we see Eden Prairie Eagles here testify at the state, and I can say for certain that Mr. Landvik made Senator Swadzinski's day because I texted him as I was sitting in this testimony. So, Madam Chair and members, I am here today to present House File 1, the PRO Act. Almost 50 years ago, the United States Supreme Court assured individuals privacy and bodily autonomy in accessing reproductive health care through Roe v. Wade. In Minnesota, our privacy and bodily autonomy similarly hangs in the balance on the legal precedent of Doe v. Gomez. Simply put, what happened to Roe may happen here in Minnesota too. Over mere months, 15 states across the country have banned abortion. And this past election, voters in Minnesota spoke, and across the country, spoke decisively and told us that they believe that every Minnesotan should be able to make their own health care decisions. House File 1, the Protect Reproductive Options, or the PRO Act, establishes the fundamental right for every Minnesotan to make decisions about their own reproductive health care, including the right to utilize contraception, family planning and fertility supports, the right to carry a pregnancy to term, and the right to abortion. These decisions are deeply personal and private and should be made by a patient and their doctor. The PRO Act is a short, simple bill that will protect Minnesotans' reproductive freedom and codify our rights into law. So I'll do a quick walkthrough. Obviously, House Research is on hand if anyone has any specific questions about the breakdown of the verbiage. But Subdivision 1 establishes the title, Protect Reproductive Options Act. Subdivision 2 defines reproductive health care. This includes but is not limited to contraception, sterilization, preconception care, maternity care, family planning and fertility services, and counseling regarding reproductive health care. Subdivision 3 establishes the fundamental right to reproductive health care in statute. Subdivision 4 recognizes the fundamental right to reproductive health care that's established in the Minnesota State Constitution. And Subdivision 5 prohibits local units of government from regulating an individual's ability to exercise the fundamental rights set forth in this section more restrictively than set forth in this section. So, Madam Chair, at this time, I'm happy to move on to testifiers.
Yep, I know that part of your presentation, we've got Professor Steenson here, so I'm going to call up Professor Mike Steenson. I don't think I ever took one of your classes, actually. Mitchell grad myself.
I did, Madam Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Mike Steenson, and I am a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. And I was asked to speak to subdivisions 3 and 4 of this bill. And as you noted, the Supreme Court of the United States has determined as a matter of federal constitutional law that abortion is not a fundamental right. And that's the Dobbs case from the past term in the Supreme Court. In Minnesota, and I believe Christy Hall will speak in more detail to this later on, the Supreme Court of Minnesota has held under the Minnesota Constitution that there is a fundamental right of a person to choose whether or not to have an abortion. That's as a matter of state constitutional law, and that's untouched by federal constitutional law. Now, this legislation, this very simple bill, does a couple of very important things. Subdivision 3 states as a matter of legislative policy that there is a fundamental right of a person to determine reproductive health care, whether to have an abortion, not to have an abortion, and it's a matter of personal autonomy. The legislation or the bill uses the term autonomous, and that relates to self-determination, the right of each individual to make decisions concerning reproductive health care. That's a matter of state policy. Subdivision 4 recognizes that there's a fundamental right to privacy under the Minnesota Constitution. And I can't emphasize enough how quickly things change. And to give you one example, the Iowa Supreme Court in 2018 held that the Iowa Constitution provides for a fundamental right of a person to determine whether or not to have an abortion. In 2022, the Iowa Supreme Court said, not so. All right, so what changed? Fundamental principles? Well, the composition of the court changed. And the point, I guess, is that it's possible at some point that the Supreme Court may decide that perhaps the abortion issue is not protected under the Minnesota Constitution. That leaves the legislative declaration. So if you look at Subdivision 3 and 4 together, you might think, well, it's really redundant, but it's not. So assuming that there is no constitutional right of a person to choose, that leaves the extremely important legislative policy in Subdivision 3 that establishes that there's a fundamental right of people to determine reproductive health care. Okay. And so it actually goes beyond constitutional rights that are protected in Doe versus Gomez. Constitutional litigation proceeds quite slowly. This legislation provides broader protection, and in effect, it's self-executing. To the extent that that fundamental right is violated, it would provide a basis for someone to enjoin state or local action that's in any way inconsistent with the rights provided for in that bill. It's an extremely important public policy statement. And I'll stop there and see if there are any questions.
All right, thank you. We're going to go ahead with public testimony because we've got a pretty long list. But if you're able to stick around, that'd be great. But understand that folks have other places they got to be as well. So with that, and just a reminder for our public testifiers that we'll be limiting testimony to a minute and a half each. I believe you all were warned about that when you signed up. But just so we're clear, first on the list, I have Mr. Brian Gibson. And then on deck, we've got Dr. Paul Post.
Hmm. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Gibson. I'm the Executive Director of Pro-Life Action Ministries here in St. Paul. And I thank you for this opportunity to offer testimony this morning. The unborn are human beings. This is not stated as a philosophical or religious viewpoint, though it certainly is, but rather this is being stated as a scientific fact, an unrefuted scientific fact. The unborn are indeed human beings. Human beings, by virtue of being human, have intrinsic and, as our founders made clear, inalienable human rights. These rights exist, whether recognized or denied, for all human beings. Of course, we recognize that the rights of any class of human beings are indeed human rights, including the rights of women. But by virtue of justice, there cannot be a true human right that relies on or causes the oppression, or in the case of this legislation before us today, the cause of the death of another human being. Voting in favor of House File 1 is a denial of science, a denial of human rights, and therefore a denial of justice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Paul Post, and then on deck I have Ms. Christy Hall.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm testifying in opposition to HF1. My name is Paul Post, MD. I'm a retired family physician, having practiced family medicine in Minnesota for 40 years. For 27 of those years, I included obstetrics in my practice and delivered over 900 babies. My opposition to this bill is focused on the following points. The language in the bill is quite extreme, talking of the rights of individuals, but does not define what is meant by an individual. There's no mention in the bill of the individual rights of the unborn child, as much as pro-abortion advocates hate to admit that an unborn child may have rights. There are numerous well-documented studies that demonstrate preborn children can experience pain as early as 24 weeks, perhaps earlier. At any rate, when intrauterine surgery is performed as early as 22 weeks, analgesia and anesthesia are routinely used. Second point, the bill makes no mention of restricting late-term abortion. In fact, when an amendment to restrict late-term abortions was made at last week's committee meeting, it was turned down, and the explanation given was that these are extremely rare and only done to save the life of the mother. I cannot think of a single instance of life-threatening complications in the third trimester where the mother's life could not be saved by delivering the baby prematurely rather than going ahead with this brutal procedure. Only blocks from here that in the NICU, doctors and nurses are working feverishly to save the lives of 21 to 22-week premature babies with considerable success. Third point, the bill will not restrict abortions to young women of any age or allow parental notification.
I'll have to have you wrap up.
They will not allow parental notification. What about the horrible situation of a 14-year-old impregnated by rape or sexual abuse, and there's no requirement for the abortion clinic to notify authorities?
Dr. Post, I have to be respectful to everybody else with the same amount of time. So thank you for your testimony. Yeah, and members, that should be in your packets. Next, I have Ms. Christy Hall, and on deck, I have Dr. Teresa Collette.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christy Hall. I'm the senior staff attorney at Gender Justice, a legal and policy advocacy nonprofit here in St. Paul, and I'm here to share our support for HF1 and demonstrate the immense support for protecting and expanding abortion access across Minnesota. Gender Justice is the home of Unrestrict Minnesota, which is a coalition for reproductive rights, health, and justice in the state. Our broad coalition represents the vast majority of Minnesotans that are supportive of abortion rights. In 2019, we filed a lawsuit challenging the abortion restrictions in the state, and last July, a judge determined those restrictions were unconstitutional and permanently blocked their enforcement across the state. The lifting of these restrictions had an immediate positive effect on providers, Minnesotans seeking abortion, and others. But we should not have to go to court to protect our constitutional rights. HF1 is an important first step in protecting those rights within our law books, a right that's widely supported by Minnesotans across the state. Last month, we commissioned a poll of Minnesota voters We found that 75% of Minnesota voters want people to make their own decisions on abortion without the government interfering. The same poll found that 68% of Minnesotans specifically support the repeal of laws that restrict access to abortion. It's equally critical that we repeal those laws. Access was a clear concern.
Ms. Hall, I need you to wrap up.
Thank you. We urge you to pass HF1 and continue the vital work of making abortion care accessible to all Minnesotans.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Dr. Teresa Collette, and I have, let's see, we've got Ms. Brenda Manarchiet is on deck.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, as well as distinguished guests. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to testify in opposition. I should note that while I am the director of the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas, I'm testifying in my personal capacity and not on behalf of the university. Your Honor, I'm here to suggest that, in fact, the misnamed Protect Reproductive Options Act should actually be called Pandora's Box of Reproductive Litigation. There are four key points I want to make before this committee. If enacted, this bill will result in litigation regarding a wide variety of issues, including but not limited to state laws and constitutional provisions protecting private rights of conscience, prohibiting prostitution, requiring reporting of sexual assault of children, and defining eligibility for and the scope of medical services to be funded by Minnesota taxpayers. First, House File 1 will create irreconcilable conflicts between constitutional and statutory protections of health care providers and personnel who believe that abortion ends the life, and I quote the en banc opinion of the Eighth Circuit, a whole separate, unique, living human being. The court in that case found that Planned Parenthood could provide no evidence to the contrary and therefore declared that the statute that required women of that fact was, in fact, constitutional. This was under the regime of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, as well as Roe versus Wade. Number two, House File 1 may create challenges to Minnesota statutes prohibiting prostitution and sex trafficking. While that may sound wild, the simple fact is that those laws have already...
Dr. Collette, I'll need you to wrap up.
Thank you. Those laws have already been challenged twice. I've submitted revised written testimony, and with the permission of the chair, I'd like that to be entered into the record. Because of the speed with which this bill is passing throughout the legislature, it's simply not possible for people to get notice of the hearing and prepare adequately for the testimony, so I've corrected the typos.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony. We did notice this with plenty of time, as is in our rules. Next, I've got Ms. Brenda Manarchiet, and I've got Ms. Bukta on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for hearing my testimony. My name is Brenda Manarchiet. I'm a member of the First Nations people, and at 17, my boss drugged and raped me, and I became pregnant, and I decided to have an abortion. And for seven times, for various reasons, I was turned away. And at the last time, a bomb went off at the clinic, and I knew that I was meant to have this child, and I did. Later, I met a charming man who turned out to be pure evil, who held me hostage, raped me repeated times, and trafficked me. I became pregnant with his child. Later, after he was arrested, my family had convinced me to have an abortion, and I did. And after the abortion, my life went totally downhill. I turned to drugs, alcohol, and sex to numb my pain. I made a lot of poor choices, but I became pregnant again. And I decided to have another abortion. And this abortion nearly killed me. I nearly hemorrhaged to death, winding up having to have an emergency hysterectomy. Years later, I still had survivor's guilt, shame, grieving the loss of my children. I attempted suicide. I became institutionalized. And after decades of medication and counseling, I was deemed mentally disabled.
Brenda, thank you for your testimony. We'll have to wrap up. Yep. I'm sorry about what you've gone through. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I've got Ms. Bukta up and Ms. Ray Parker on deck.
Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Manali Bhakta, and I'm a first-year law student at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minneapolis and a member of the Minnesota Young Women's Initiative Cabinet. I am honored to advocate for House File 1, which establishes the fundamental right for reproductive health care to be codified into Minnesota statutes. This right was abruptly stripped away across the nation as the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year. The overturning of 50 years of precedent was an upsetting outcome for marginalized communities who are most impacted by institutional discrimination against their reproductive rights. After years of discrimination, silencing, and abuse of forced sterilization in the healthcare industry, it is important for us to enter the reproductive justice conversation. I have seen up close how historically underrepresented groups are neglected during important policy discussions and have suffered from preventing our voices from being heard. The goal of quality reproductive health care is to ensure individuals without the financial and personal privilege to bear children have access to health care designed for the purpose of preventing pregnancy, and this bill will create that right for all women. It is important to center the narrative around BIPOC communities whose lived experiences are too frequently ignored regarding the importance of preserving this fundamental human right. This is what motivates me to study law.
I need you to wrap up your testimony. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you. This is what motivates me to study law, and then in addition to that, encourage the committee to pass House File 1.
Thank you. Ms. Ray Parker, and then I've got Ms. Munira Mohammed on deck.
Good morning. My name is Ray Parker. I'm here speaking today to express my objection to the HF1 bill. This bill, so deceptively named the Reproductive Health Bill, does exactly the opposite of its name. This, in almost every incident, ends in death, because it is designed to end in death, the death of our most vulnerable people and our most precious resource, especially when you consider this bill supports the death of these infants up to the time of birth. For what reason? At that point, just put the infant up for adoption. Women have health care and reproductive health care where no one ends up dead. If women don't want children, all they need to do is go to their health care providers, and there are several ways to prevent pregnancy. There's no reason or excuse to kill the youngest of our civilization. If you proceed with this barbaric, evil, demonic practice of infanticide, you will propagate the end of our civilization. For you must have a regard for life to uphold a civilization, to stop violence and create safety for all. This rampant decline in our cities and country has its roots in a lack of valuing human life. Please show us that you value life and civility by voting no to the HF1 bill. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony and for preparing the right length of testimony. Next, I've got Ms. Munira Mohammed. Please go ahead and introduce yourself. I've got Rebecca Messel on deck.
Hello, Chair Becker Finn and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Munira Mohammed. I'm from the ACLU of Minnesota. That's the American Civil Liberties Union, a longstanding organization devoted to restoring and preserving the individual rights and liberties enshrined in our Constitution. I'm here to speak in support of the PRO Act regarding reproductive health rights. This is a timely and urgent civil liberties issue dealing with bodily autonomy and reproductive freedom. ACLU of Minnesota believes in protecting the fundamental rights and dignity of individuals to make choices about their own bodies without interference from the government. Autonomy and privacy are at the core of this issue. People should have the right to make private healthcare choices unobstructed and unmediated by some outside source. While the PRO Act is a good way to codify reproductive rights, we urge the legislature to not stop there. There's a long list of other legislation that's needed to repeal unfortunate and unnecessary restrictions. I think that bill is HF 91 and it just dropped. And it should be noted that this is despite a district judge striking these restrictions down as unconstitutional under our state constitution. Just passing the PRO Act and not going further could potentially risk a situation where reproductive rights are codified in state law and yet not meaningfully accessed by those who need it most. This is a conundrum that ACLU faces the most, and we always express, what good is a right if you can't exercise it? The ACLU Minnesota is supportive of the PRO Act and the other proposals to protect and expand reproductive freedom. Thank you to the chair and the members.
All right, thank you. Ms. Rebecca Messel, and then I've got Elena Niehoff on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Rebecca Messel, speaking only for myself as a voter in Maple Grove, but also as a litigation attorney in civil rights. I ask the committee to reject HF1. It prohibits local governments from regulating what Bill calls fundamental rights about an individual's reproductive health. It thus applies to men and children and not just adult women. It does not protect full-term or viable babies, and it conflicts with a federal law against partial birth abortion. In Doe versus Gomez, the state Supreme Court invoked its strictest level of judicial scrutiny to review a Medicaid statute denying abortion funding. The court classified abortion as a fundamental right in that situation. The Gomez case did not involve minors, men, late-term abortion, or the litany of things that HF1 says are suddenly fundamental rights. In saying this, HF1 violates the state constitution's Article 3, Section 1. It prohibits the legislative branch from intruding upon the authority of the judicial branch to interpret the state constitution. It also expands beyond abortion to protect other businesses regarding very elastic categories such as preconception and managing pregnancy loss, which could include the disposal of human remains. Interpreting the state constitution as creating fundamental rights for men and children and these additional types of businesses is purely the province of the judicial branch. HF1 violates Article 3, Section 1 because the state constitution does not expressly authorize the legislature to enlarge upon the judicial ruling in Gomez. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Elena Niehoff. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the Congress. My name is Elena Niehoff. I am a registered nurse. And I just would like to remind that any law which supersedes the Constitution is null and void. This bill supersedes the Constitution. It should be null and void. I'm speaking here in the objection of the bill HF1. The actions of the Democrat majority in the House caused grief to many parents, grandparents, and the people of faith. According to Minnesota law, our children now can get the medical procedure like an abortion without parental consent or any parental involvement. That's so much for the support for American families. I would like to remind what role was given to the government by our founding fathers. I will quote John Quincy Adams, ask the Declaration of Independence, and that will tell you that its authors held for self-evident truth that the rights for life is the first of unalienable rights of men. And to secure and not to destroy that right, governments are instituted among men. I'm all for protecting the rights of people. In the case of medical procedure like abortion, two people undergo the procedure, a woman and an unborn child.
Ms. Niehoff, I'll need you to wrap up.
F1 bill protects only the rights of the woman and disregards the rights of unborn child. That is prosecuting minority. Unborn children. Thank you for your testimony.
All right, we don't have any additional testifiers signed up, but I do want to allow the public, if there's anyone from the public who would like to testify, you'll also be limited to a minute and a half, and I've got time for a couple if there are folks here who would like to testify.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. Good morning.
I'm an attorney. I've practiced 30 years, about 1,000 cases, most of them involving the government, maybe about 300 appeals. I've narrowed my mind to understand what the law is. And if I were a law professor, I would give this bill an F. And some of the presentations suggested that there was a waiver of sovereign immunity here to sue in court if these laws are exceeded. That's not true. The private cause of action, this legislature determines whether someone can sue the government. The federal courts agree with me. The state courts agree with me. The attorney general's office agrees with me. But somehow people come into this committee and they say, well, if you pass this law without an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity authorizing a private lawsuit, it's okay. We got to fix that. This legislature determines when people can sue the government. There's no implicit right to sue the government in the Minnesota Constitution. There's no in this law, there's no explicit waiver of sovereign immunity allowing citizens to sue the government. They violate this purported right. This is an F. We need to go back and rewrite it. The Declaratory Judgment Act does not provide a private cause of action. The Minnesota Constitution doesn't provide a private cause of action. If this legislature wants to create a private cause of action, then put it in the bill. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for keeping. All right, just please introduce yourself for the record before you go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Faith Fry, and I'm a mother, a grandmother. I've been a pastor's wife for 30 years. And I'm coming as a mother. I'm coming as a grandmother. Because 48 years ago, I could not have children. And I pray to God that I have children. My son is a special ed a teacher now. He's a doctor, a special ed. My other daughter, she was in law school too, and a missionary in England. But I come as a mother and a grandmother. That these two gifts of my children and my grandchildren are the greatest gifts. This is not political. This is not something that I would discard. I love my children. I love my grandchildren. I'm glad that there was two situations in our family that that my daughter-in-law and another girl could have aborted. My grandchildren, they did not. They chose life. Yes, it was hard for them. It was hard for them because I know that the financial cost of that situation. But I'm so glad that November 26th, I saw my grandson married. I'm not Republican. I'm not Democrat. I'm a mother, and I love motherhood. I love being a grandmother. So it's just on a moral situation, the joy of being a mother, the joy of being a grandmother. That's why I come today. I'm not a hater or against this one or that.
Yeah, I'll need you to wrap up.
Yes, thank you. So I speak to the joy of motherhood. I speak to the joy of grandmotherhood. So that's my testimony, and I'm almost 69 years old. So thank you very much.
All right, and if you can make sure you sign up with the page since we didn't have your name ahead of time, that would be helpful. All right, and this will wrap up public testimony so we can get to the amendments.
My name is Christine Wheely, and I would urge all of you to consider pushing this bill out and kindly listening to the amendments. I have put forth legislation through the entire country that would satisfy what the left is asking in regards to mothers who would like to have an abortion in regards to rape, incest, and murder. Rape, incest, and the medical emergencies of that. That is before you. I would like you to hear that out, okay? My mother did choose life for me. My family did come out of North Minneapolis. My grandmother was left on a doorstep at 3 days old because she was considered mulatto. Because of that, she was given to a family in Alabama. And at 3 days old, she was left there. And the crises of pregnancy, unplanned pregnancy, all of those things, my family has walked through that. My family is of color. I am the oldest of 43 grandchildren. 20 other grandchildren are in heaven because of abortion. But my mother also chose life for me right here in St. Paul at 14 years old. She was raped by her stepfather. And my mother was homeless because of that. There's many pieces that are not being told right now because of time. But she was homeless. An unwed mother's home right next to the governor's mansion took her in. My dad, who I met at 24 years old,
took her in because of the abuses and heard her story. But he also chose to give me, the state would have taken me away if my mom had stayed.
I'm going to have you wrap
17
up.
17 years older than her. But he chose to sign my birthrights to my adopted father. And I just want to say to you that there's legislation that is in support of what both sides want. And I ask you, I have it, I will present
it. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Review that and listen clearly to these amendments, okay?
Yep, well, that's, we're trying to get to the amendments, yes. But thank you for your testimony. With that, we will move on to the amendments. First, we've got the A6-1 amendment. Representative Scott, I believe that's your amendment. If you want to go ahead and move and then explain your amendment.
Yes, I'd like to move the A6-1 amendment for the committee. Madam Chair, before I get started on that, what is the lay of the land? I don't think the next committee comes until 10:30. Are we able to go over a little bit?
Yep, we've been given until 10:15. Thank you for being aware of that.
Thank you. Members of the committee, this amendment says that the fundamental right to abortion does not include partial birth abortion or third trimester abortions unless it falls under one of the following exceptions: the life or preservation of the health of the mother, rape or incest or other criminal sexual conduct, and that it does not prohibit the state from regulating abortion facilities. I would ask for members' support. In its current form, this bill is very extreme, allowing for an abortion up to birth. We've heard testimony from physicians about the viability of life. The science is very clear. There are babies, as one indicated right now, down at Regions and at Children's here in St. Paul, where these babies are at 20 weeks conception, or 20 weeks, and they're making it. So, members, please support this very, very reasonable amendment. And with that, I would take questions.
Yep. Response to the amendment, Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the A6 amendment, in speaking about late-term abortion or partial birth abortion, very simply, partial birth abortion doesn't happen. Infanticide is already illegal. This amendment is extreme in that it's speaking about these things and accusing medical professionals of killing babies. It just doesn't happen. It's not how labor and delivery works. It's not how abortion care works. And the truth is that even in third trimester situations, these abortions are extremely rare. They're almost exclusively done for a severe fetal diagnosis. It's important that we consider the health and life of the mother and other situations, but I don't think that there is anyone who can truly imagine what it would be like to go into, a 20-week ultrasound or a later follow-up ultrasound and be told that your pregnancy, your baby, is not going to make it outside the womb. And so I think that in those very rare circumstances, an individual needs to be able to make those decisions with their doctor and without interference from politicians. So members, I would ask you to vote no on the A6.
Thank you. And we'll move to discussion of the amendment. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, thank you for bringing this common sense amendment forward. Listening to the rebuttal here from the bill author,
Representative Katiza Witun,
I think of my friend's child. What you described, they were told. And the doctors suggested aborting the child. That's a wonderful child, no issues whatsoever. They would have killed a beautiful little girl who's a straight-A student. But the doctor said she wouldn't live. Thank you for this amendment, and I request a roll call.
All right, a roll call has been requested. Any further discussion to the amendment? We'll just go to closing from Representative Scott.
All right, sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Katiza Watoon, I'm shocked that you would call this amendment extreme. In some states where abortion, very similar, you know, a statute that's gone into law like this bill that you've presented, this abortion until birth bill, when those kind of laws are passed, it invites those third-term abortion doctors into those states. You cannot tell me that these don't happen. They absolutely do. Are they rare? Yes. But what is the harm in taking something that would is basically infanticide and putting it into statute and saying, you know what, even if you are for the rest of this bill and what it stands for, we are at least going to stand for a child that's totally viable outside of the womb. Your position is extreme. Members, I ask for a yes vote.
All right. With that, we'll move to the vote. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weins.
Yes.
With five ayes, with five ayes and eight noes, the amendment does not prevail. With that, we'll move to the A7 amendment. Representative Niska, I believe that's your amendment. If you would like to move your amendment and then go ahead and explain it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do move the A7 amendment, but I think it's important for me to clarify that I did not write the A7 amendment. The words of the A7 amendment are not the words of Representative Harry Niska. They are the words of Justice Harry Blackmun in the Supreme Majority opinion in Roe versus Wade. And let me just read for the record the quotations the language that's being offered to be put into our statutes. From Roe versus Wade, 410 U.S. Reports 113 at page 154, the majority opinion said, a state may properly assert important interests in safeguarding health, in maintaining medical standards, and in protecting potential life. And on pages 164 to 165, again using the U.S. report citation, the majority opinion in Roe versus Wade said, for the stage subsequent to viability, the state, in promoting its interest in the potentiality of human life, may, if it chooses, regulate and even prescribe abortion except where it is necessary, in appropriate medical judgment for the preservation of the life and health of the mother. So the A7 amendment, this amendment, is the Codify Roe amendment. It is the amendment to, instead of taking the extreme, most extreme position we can take on this policy issue, it is to take the more moderate and reasonable position laid out by the majority opinion in Roe versus Wade. And the bill author, Representative Katiza Watoon, invoked Roe versus Wade at the beginning of her presentation over and over again on the campaign trail and before the legislature. We've heard this bill referred to as the Codify Roe bill. Rochelle Olson of the Star Tribune even called it the Codify Roe bill. But it's not. It's not. Not unamended. And so this is an attempt to offer an olive branch to help make it into the actual Codify Roe bill, or at least a little bit more reasonable. These are not my words. These are not the words I would use. It's not the way I would strike the balance between, on the one hand, the right of women to health and medical standards, the right of the unborn human baby to ever have rights. This is not where I would strike the balance, but it is a significant, more moderate, reasonable step than the bill is unamended. And so I urge members to support the A7 amendment, and I request a roll call, Madam Chair.
Okay, and I can't remember. Did you actually move the amendment?
I did, yeah.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Okay, roll call has been requested. Response, Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to clarify that I've never called this bill the Codify Roe bill. So, you know, I mean, I can't speak for other folks who might be misunderstanding. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court of the United States, they said that it's a state's rights decision. The voters of Minnesota have given the DFL a trifecta. This is one of the big issues that I heard over and over again on the campaign trail. And just to go a little bit further in terms of this verbiage, I mean, when we look at protecting reproductive rights in the state of Minnesota, every pregnancy is unique, and viability, medically, the exact date of viability varies and can differ with each unique pregnancy. So I would point members to lines 1.17, 1.18, where this bill specifically protects the pregnant individual's right to continue their pregnancy and give birth. We know that later stage abortions are exceedingly rare, to the tune that 4 Minnesotans had a third trimester abortion in 2021, the last year that we have data for. So of all the births, of all of the unfortunate miscarriages, this bill does not expand a current gestational limit. This bill simply guarantees the rights of each Minnesotan to make decisions about their own reproductive health care. And I think that, if you look too far into this this amendment's verbiage, one could argue that it's looking to create a government-controlled forced birth. So Minnesotans believe that politics has no place in the doctor's office, and I would ask members to vote no on the A7.
All right. Any discussion to the A7 amendment? All right. Seeing none, Representative Niska, any closing comments on the amendment?
Yes. This is a revealing vote. It is going to show to the people of Minnesota what this bill really is. And I appreciate the bill author's clarification that this is not a bill to codify Roe. It is a bill to go significantly further than what the majority opinion went in Roe versus Wade, to be considerably more extreme. And once again, I do for the sake of moderation, for the sake of giving some weight to the voice of the completely voiceless and unrepresented in this bill. It's not as much weight as I believe those rights are due. This is not a theoretical issue for me. As some of you may know, my wife was a legislative staffer here in 2011. She was a legislative assistant. She was on the floor of the House carrying our child, Jude, as members of this body debated whether he would ever have any rights of bodily autonomy whatsoever, whether he had any rights. On January 2nd or January 3rd, Jude, I met Governor Walz. He has rights now. But there are thousands of unborn Minnesota babies right now and millions to come whose rights, whose interests are completely unrepresented and HF1 is unamended. Don't do that. Please at least do something to recognize their rights and vote for this amendment. Thank you.
All right, Representative Niska has moved the A7 amendment before us and requested a roll call. The clerk will take the roll on the A7 amendment.
Chair Becker-Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Niska?
Yes.
Representative Weens?
Yes.
With 5 ayes and 8 noes, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. All right. So now back to the underlying bill. We've got a couple people on the list already for general discussion of the bill. So we've got House File 1 in front of us. First on the list, I've got Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I just want to take a step back a few days. We had a bill in here where I reminded us, reminded all of us, we're all made in the image of God. We're all made in the God in God's image. And just about everybody in the room sitting at this table right now gave an affirmative head nod. Yes, we are. And I add to that, we were fearfully and wonderfully made, knit in our mother's womb. We're a creator right there. And I want you to think about that and keep that in mind. Now, go to my question. Representative Katiza Watoon, does this bill with no safeguards or regulations for abortion apply to minors? I'm concerned this bill does nothing to protect vulnerable girls. As you know, based on my experience with law enforcement, my mind goes to such concerns as I've been working on legislation to protect our children since I walked through these doors three biennials ago. Not only does this legislation open the door to extreme abortion procedures without limitation, nothing in the bills ensures minors are protected against being sexually assaulted or abused or preyed upon. Sex trafficking is a huge problem in Minnesota, a huge problem. That's not disputed. According to 2020 research from the University of Minnesota School of Nursing, together with Minnesota Department of Health, state at least 5,000 high school-aged youth in the state have traded sex in order to receive money, food, drugs, alcohol, a place to stay, or something else of value. And I can provide a link for you to look that stuff up if you need it. How can you ensure, in the absence of any guardrails or safeguards, that this legislation won't be abused by dangerous individuals?
Representative Katiza Watoon, response.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Grossel. Sexual assault and all the horrible things that you mentioned that do happen here in Minnesota and across the world are already legal. I don't think that this bill is the place to reiterate things that are already in state statute. I don't think that we can guarantee that bad actors, even if we included verbiage to that effect in the PRO Act, wouldn't do the things that you're insinuating that bad actors do and take advantage of young folks. My main concern is that should somebody, you know, have a situation where that happened and for whatever reason not realize that they're pregnant until late in their pregnancy, or get terrible news at that point in their pregnancy, that then they have the right to access that reproductive health care at the point when they want it. So I mean, this codifies this right for every individual in the state of Minnesota. Should somebody need to access any of the services listed, and not just abortion care, but counseling and maternity care and all of those things. So that's my answer.
Yep, and I'll just remind members, we can be in this room till 10:15, and then we can also come back at 12:15 if we want to continue with the discussion. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I figured that's the answer that I was going to receive. But this bill clearly does not have guidelines that will protect minors. You're allowing these abortions to occur for minors without parental notification. Someone who's being sex trafficked, they could be brought in, allowed to get an abortion, brought right back out. Someone who's been raped by an adult, to keep them quiet, want to keep their dignity, want to keep their name good, brings that person and brings that minor in for an abortion. Are there guidelines that will prevent these things from happening? And they're telling me no. That is my concern, Madam Chair. That is my concern to all of us, You look at this, and there's no guidelines to protect these young girls who may have been raped, who may have been trafficked, and they can just be brought in without anybody, any adult or guardian notification, parental notification, and the cycle will continue.
Thank you, Representative Grossel. Representative Johnson. Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that this bill is in the committee for the fundamental right piece. Mm-hmm. And so I have a few questions regard to that, and then some that also extend from there. Representative Katiza Watun, is it your understanding that this language would legalize surrogacy arrangements, both those in which the surrogate mother is not paid and those for which they are?
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. I think that's a great question. We don't specify surrogacy arrangements in the definition here. We could add that. I mean, if that is something, certainly every journey into parenthood is unique, and I think that, you know, we could explore adding that if that's something that people would like to discuss.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Katiza Watun, you have language in here that speaks to fertility treatments, isn't that right, or something to that effect? Many times that would cross over with surrogacy. What you're telling me is you don't have a definitive answer on whether surrogacy arrangements of any kind would be covered under your bill.
Well, Representative Scott, surrogacy arrangements are typically contractual between two parties, and I think whether somebody receives the services or not wouldn't necessarily, whatever kind of contract someone has outside of the right to the treatment is kind of a separate issue. But Representative Katiza Watun, any further follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the further clarification, Representative Scott. Some people, like I said, every journey into parenthood is unique. I myself went through several failed fertility treatments, ended up myself with an unplanned pregnancy in COVID. We never explored surrogacy services, but I know that many, many people do here in Minnesota. I know many individuals who have done that. I think counseling regarding reproductive health care, if somebody was going to explore surrogacy, it would maybe fall under that area. But as Representative Becker-Finn talked about, contracting outside of just accessing, you know, or being able to make the decisions about your own reproductive health care, I think that it falls kind of within that. But
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Katiza Watun, well, anytime you walk into a doctor's office, you're really under contract. You're under contract. You're paying them for a service. So this would be basically no different. To the bill's author, Madam Chair and Representative Katiza Watun, does the fundamental right extend up until birth in this bill?
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is no expansion of gestational limits included in the text of this bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not sure what the answer was there. Yes or no, does this extend? Does the fundamental right that you allude to in this bill extend up to birth?
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the text of this bill, there is no expansion of any gestational limit.
So I take that that this is a yes then, from what you just said.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, this bill allows every Minnesotan to access reproductive health care, period.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this fundamental right, Representative Katiza Watun, apply for any reason? Say the mother finds out that their child has Down syndrome and decides that they don't want to raise a child with Down syndrome. Does this fundamental right apply for any reason?
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, this
the language in this bill provides that every Minnesotan has the right to reproductive health care and that they can make those decisions with their doctor without the interference from politicians like us.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm assuming that that is a yes. Madam Chair and Representative Katiza-Witun, would this also apply, let's say that the mother was really hoping for a boy, but the ultrasound shows that it's a girl, or the blood test now that they can do. Would this fundamental right extend for any reason, such as sex selection?
Representative Katiza-Witun, and we're at 10:14. but go ahead, Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Protect Reproductive Options Act, Representative Scott, provides access for every Minnesotan to access reproductive health care, counseling regarding reproductive health care, fertility services.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, again, that is a yes. Does this fundamental right to reproductive freedom trump other rights, such as the right of conscience or religion? And I don't think, Madam Chair and Representative Katiza-Witun, you can use the answer that you've been giving me. This is a completely different issue. Does it trump the right to conscience and religion?
Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, this is an additional fundamental right. We're not ranking fundamental rights of Minnesotans here.
Representative Scott, and let's be careful to not put words into the mouth of the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Katiza-Witun, we have a Bill of Rights that protects our religious freedom. And actually, by the answer that you gave, you're alluding to what some other testifiers said, that this is going to be the Wild West in the courts. The courts are going to be left to make such a decision on when your fundamental right that you're trying to establish is in conflict with right of conscience or religion. And they're going to be forced to decide what trumps what. The language of this bill seems to instruct the courts to give not just women access to any form of reproductive health care. If you layer this with the findings in Doe v. Gomez, does this mean that the taxpayers will be paying for IVF, which is between $15,000 and $30,000 per treatment, or something like Viagra for erectile dysfunction? Will this language require that the taxpayer be on the hook for those items, such items?
Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, this language does not guarantee coverage for these issues. It just allows each Minnesotan to make their own reproductive health care decisions.
I think I've seen where other constitutionally mandated rights that we have are not required necessarily to be funded as well, as we discussed earlier today in this committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this will be my final question for the bill's author. Thank you for allowing me to ask the questions. In the testimony from Professor Collette, at least the one that I read over last night, on page 5, the paragraph right above the conclusion, I don't know if you have that in front of you, but do you agree or disagree that House File 1 would cause taxpayers to fund all abortions, sex assignment surgeries, and fertility drugs?
Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I don't have that printed testimony in front of me, but thank you. But I wholeheartedly disagree that the text of the PRO Act requires taxpayers to pay for any of these services. It simply guarantees the right of Minnesotans to access such care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Scott.
I'll just make my final comments here because I know we're in a push for time, but this bill is extreme. It's the abortion till birth bill. This doesn't take into regard a baby that is totally viable outside of the womb. We've tried even just to make an exception for third trimester abortions. It's a sad day when a baby can be subject
to this kind of mutilation and harm. It's a sad day when we elected officials can't stand up for the rights of that child. I understand a woman's right to choose reproduction, if you will. That decision should be made before the sexual encounter. There are cases, we've offered them exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mom. We've offered those exceptions, and they were, that used to be back in the 70s, you know, we used to hear safe, legal, and rare, and exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mom. I think that's more in line with where the public is. I don't think the DFL trifecta necessarily means that Minnesotans are with you on this extreme of a bill that allows the abortion of a child up into birth. So, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair and members, I would encourage a no vote on House File 1. Thank you.
All right. And with that, we'll move on to the vote. I will renew my motion that House File 1 be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee.
Can we have a roll call, please?
I was wondering if you guys are going to do that. All right. A roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on House File 1.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Pinky.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel. Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
All right. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to State and Local Government Finance and Policy. Thank you, members, for your diligence today. With that, we are adjourned.